This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. Hello and welcome to the CIO call for July, where alongside Sonia's latest macroeconomic insights, we'll be focusing on credit, both public and private, against a potential background of higher for longer interest rates. By way of quick introduction, I'm Frances Watson, content manager here at LGIM, and I'm delighted to be joined by our CIO, Sonia Loud, Mark Benstead, head of active credit solutions on the public credit side, and Stu Hitchcock, head of portfolio management on the private credit side. Hello to you all, and thank you for joining LGIM Talks.
Hello.
Hi.
So, Sonia, let's just start with you. I mean, stock market volatility remains low. Investors in bonds and equities remain divided over the recession question, and inflation remains stubbornly high. Does that mean our views for the second half of the year remain the same?
But it's indeed a very good question, and I'm sure every investor is currently grappling with exactly those data points and trying to understand what to make of this for the second half. But given that it is early July, it probably is worth taking a step back and just looking back onto the first half of 2022, because clearly we've had some reasonable and to some extent outstanding results, particularly when you look at equities. So we've had 39% for the Nasdaq in the US. We've had 16% of for the Euro Stoxx 50. And so, you know, very, very respectable returns across equity land, which probably gives you an indication that most investors probably have been buying into the Goldilocks scenario, i.e. we have had a more resilient economic backdrop with the expectation that inflation would come down to a more manageable level. And that remains the balancing act, and this will be the main story for the second half. And exactly as you pointed out, it depends on which camp you are sitting in. Our view hasn't changed. The timing is different, but the view hasn't changed that we do not believe that interest rates will just, you know, be absorbed by the economy and will be absorbed by economic participants without having a real impact. And so the timing, clearly, we have been wrong in the context of us expecting the recession to happen around now. But if you look at the latest indicators, we still believe there's nothing in the data that would say that interest rates will not, with a time lag, have an impact on the real economy. And I'm sure we will hear more of that within the credit section. Inflation, again, has definitely come in some areas, particularly in the UK, with an upside surprise. In Europe and the US, probably more in line with expectation. But it is still not at a level that would give central banks the comfort that they could start kind of making more supportive sounds, i.e. moving towards a more accommodative stance. And as such, we're still waiting to see, and there's an expectation that the UK, the Bank of England, clearly is not done. There's expectation as well that both the Fed and the ECB will have to come in with more interest rate hikes. And all of them have been unanimous that they will not stop prematurely. They're all very aware that the data we're getting on the inflationary front is still not easing enough. Labor markets are very tight, and as such, they all will be watching wage inflation with particular interest, because that will be a key ingredient in their decision-making process. So where does it leave us with regards to the outlook for the second half? Well, let's start with the fact valuations are very rich. So the equity risk premium on the S&P 500 is at a 16-year low. So we're back to 2007 levels. That might ring an alarm bell for some, but it gives you an indication that obviously there is a lot of positivity priced in. We should call out as well that breadth in markets has not been particularly strong. So a lot of our listeners and a lot of investors will have watched the AI-driven rally in tech stocks in the US, Nvidia in particular. So breadth has been very, very narrow. So what this means is that not all companies have benefited from this kind of Goldilocks scenario that I've outlined earlier. And normally is a warning sign, because you will only want to buy into a positive market backdrop if you really see that this is a widespread phenomenon. And as such, we will continue to watch very carefully how the inflationary data is coming in particular, because the market probably is not well prepared for more rate hikes. And regardless whether it's more rate hikes, it's the It's the fact that rates will remain higher for longer, which probably then is the other dampening effect that we will see on markets going forward. So the balancing act remains. We keep our position that we do expect the economy to weaken significantly in the second half of this year. Europe probably is a clearer indication because the data has softened quite considerably, but it's the US obviously that is still hanging in there. But we do expect even there that interest rates finally will have an impact on the economic activity. And as such, we do expect that risk assets might be in for a weaker spot in the second half.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for outlining that so very clearly for us, Sonia, as always. Stu, we are focusing on public and private credit. So let's just kick off with you and the perceptions of private credit, if we may. It's an asset class that's grown considerably, hasn't it, since the aftermath of the global financial crisis. And it's typically seen as lending to risky, relatively small companies. Is that a fair assumption?
I'm very glad you asked me this, Francis, because I think I answer this question multiple times every year. I've been doing it for 20 years. No, it's not a fair assumption. It's not a fair characterization, although the sub-investment grade space, and in particular that leverage space that's often referred to in the, if you like, the media, does make a part of the overall private credit universe. A lot of references to private credit are indeed focused on those more leveraged strategies, often described in the context of direct lending or leverage fund strategies. And although they've existed for some time, their growth has really been pronounced over recent years as investors sought that higher yield, in inverted commas, in an historically low interest rate environment. And and also we've seen that lending move from banks to institutional investors. But the fact is, it's only a part of the overall private credit markets. And broadly speaking, I think you can split private credit in half. The other half is this $1 trillion equivalent investment grade, higher quality space. And we broadly describe that as investment grade credits and also the crossover space, which is really double B. And that's existed for decades. And that's really the space, the investment grade space that we as a house invest in on behalf of our clients. It's their markets, whether it's corporate, infrastructure, real estate, debt, or the alternative space that borrowers and investors know and love. It's used for credit diversification, asset liability management strategies, amongst other things, as well as getting structural enhancements and a pricing premium over equivalent public comparables. I won't go into all of the basics of what private credit really is, but I think most people will be aware, it's lending to any manner of issuers, whether it's publicly rated corporates, infrastructures, assets backed by contracted cash flows, prime real estate that benefits from longer term contracted cash flows. And it's in multiple currencies, whether that's sterling, US dollars, euros, CAD, Aussie dollars, just to name a few. And the quid pro quo of a private, which is effectively an unlisted asset, is that you benefit from some form of structural protection, either by in the way of financial and non-financial covenants or security. So there's very good data. As I say, these markets have been around now for a number of decades, almost 100 years, actually, for US corporates. And there's a lot of data to demonstrate the recovery rates of these and how they these private assets and how often they can be superior because of those protections to some other asset classes like public bonds. But I think, as I say, to summarise, a lot of the market commentary often equates private credit with those more leveraged strategies. And that really, in my opinion, doesn't give the long established IG world as much of a spotlight as it sometimes, I think, deserves. And saying that, I do sense that it's changing, potentially as some trepidation creeps in about the lower credit grade space will perform over the cycle. Mm-hmm. And also the fact now that we're in a higher interest rate world, and so therefore the investment grade space is generating some very attractive returns in our opinion.
Okay, we are going to talk about cycles a little later on in the podcast, but I guess what a lot of listeners on this call will want to know is about valuations and how you value, particularly in that investment grade space, Stu. I mean, I'm looking back to March when there were a lot of jitters, weren't there, over the regional bank crisis and the fact that the regional banks in particular had not marked to market their assets. So big question is, how do you value your private credit, at least at the IG end?
Right. So I think this is a really important point. And rightly or wrongly, I think this mark-to-market situation is going to be a real issue for the financial markets in the future. And after the dust settles, I think, on this economic cycle, I think there's going to be a huge amount of scrutiny placed on mark-to-market assets. So in terms of the methodology, like public bonds, unless we have a, let's say, a public issue from the actual borrower that we're investing in, we'll select a basket of comparable credits to capture the credit and duration aspects of our investments, or an index if it's relevant. And we'll use those together with the risk-free rate when we price the asset to create a discount rate that gets applied to the cash flows of that loan or note that we're invested in. That gives us a price, and that will effectively be indicatively reflective of the credit market for that asset. And remember, you can buy and sell our private assets, and over 10% of our annual deployment actually is from secondary markets. But
Mark's shaking his head here.
Yeah,
but let me add in.
But look, it's interesting because it's not the only way to price some of these assets, and I've certainly had challenge from market participants. Of course, we hope and believe that our assets are money good, in inverted commas. But to my mind, it's really questionable to think that assets simply hold a par price during their life, given market movements or specific actions or activities with a specific credit. And the recent banking crisis that you have referred to, it's really a case in point. Because what if an investor wants or needs to sell an asset for whatever reason? So on a fixed rate side, if you're sitting on a 4% coupon investment, it's a fixed rate transaction, and the current fair market rate for that particular credit is 6%, then basic bond maths should tell you that that asset isn't, if you like, it's mark to market, it's not par. Mm. And assuming that there's been no other change to the credit. But you know, you wouldn't buy that asset today at par. And even for floating rate, where the risk free is effectively immunized, you still have a credit component. So that can be affected over time by the movement in credit spread for similar assets. Oh, and last but why not least, aren't liabilities marked to market on balance sheet as well? So I think it's a really important question. It's an issue that I think that the wider markets will have to deal with. We mark our assets to what we believe is the current market rate using a bond mass methodology.
Okay, well, you've given us a very full and frank answer there, but Mark, just outline for us where you think the differences are in your space, Mark, you know, particularly with reference to liquidity, etc. Yeah.
Thank you, Francis, and a happy July the 4th if you're celebrating today. I'll start on a cheerful note before I have a go at Stuart. So I guess everything I say about the private market has to be somewhat caveated by the fact that Stuart knows an awful lot more about the public market than I do about the private market, for obvious reasons. One's public and one's private. And frequently we talk to each other quite a lot, and I will talk about a new issue that's come, and he said, yeah, I've seen that. I know exactly where it priced at, et cetera, et cetera. I'm thinking, well, why did I bother telling you when you know already? I haven't got, to be honest, the foggiest idea, quite rightly, of where a similar deal might be pricing itself in the private world. What I do know, though, Francis, is that such has been the kind of historical demand for private credit to harvest the illiquidity premium when yields were very low, that there was for a number of years, and still is there, but I think to a lesser extent now, a very strong excess of demand over supply. And in any market where you have that kind of excess of demand over supply, the potential for buying something at the wrong price or lending money at the wrong level goes up. So that does worry me. What I do like about private credit, once you take the illiquidity into account, I'll talk about a little bit about that more later. And Stuart mentioned this, and I think underplayed it, if anything, your ability to have a covenant package that is A, bespoke, and B, really does bite when needed, is much, much better than the public market will ever
offer. Can I just clear up for those uninitiated who are not in the world of private credit? Covenants exist in the private credit market, but not in the public.
No, they do, but they'll be very simple.
Okay.
Covenants, somewhat vague, and you know, harder to enforce than the ones that still say, well, I will lend you the money, but this is what I need to see written down.
Okay, so much more stringent.
On liquidity, which I think is important, and Stuart will tell you that you can buy and sell private credit, you know, on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. Well,
he just has.
Good luck with kind of good luck with that, right? Because one thing that we did see at the end of September and into early October last year, when a lot of pension funds needed to raise collateral, that actually their ability to sell private credit down in a suitable timeline and at a suitable price was, well, Sonia will know much more about this than me, compromised would be a polite way of putting it. Extremely difficult would be another, and impossible would be another. So I think, and Stuart and I have talked about this, I think, you know, pension fund trustees looking at allocation within fixed income and looking at that experience will be perhaps questioning the attraction, or asking themselves, should we be diluting our credit exposure in favor of public, in theory, much more tradable fixed income than perhaps it has been in private. So I think that will be a theme going forward. So, and I think the other thing that Stuart looked at, the illiquidity premium, when yields are, you know, when euro high yield is yielding you 4%, then the percentage uplift you can get from private credit at, you know, 6 or 7 is pretty interesting. When 1 year gilts yield 5.25%, then every asset class has to look at itself and say, actually, you know, what are we offering over and above here? And that applies to public as much as private.
Who'd have thought that higher yield just even 12, 18 months ago? Who knew? I know Stu wants to come back to you on it, but in the interests of time, I am going to use another follow-up question for you, Mark. And Sonia alluded to it, you know, the stubborn inflation rate that we have. So, for a lot of people, the main headache at the moment, isn't it, is how on earth, as a manager of fixed income, clues in the name, you protect your portfolios against the ravages of inflation. Tell us how on earth you are managing to do a full day's work at the moment.
Okay, so for higher, I'm definitely doing full day's work. Higher for longer equals trickier for longer, I would say. And if you invite a bond person on a call, don't expect the glass to be half full, right? Because if you protecting a fixed income portfolio from the ravages of stubborn inflation is wishful thinking, okay? You literally, as you said, Francis, you know, there's a clue in the title, the income is fixed. And when the real purchasing power of that income is eroded, guess what's going to happen to the price of that underlying instrument? So you can't do it, okay? There are ways in which you can minimize the impact, okay? You can be as underweight duration as your mandate might allow you to be. You can trade duration, and good luck with that. On a kind of bottom-up corporate credit side, absolutely, we can try and own companies where, you know, we believe they have the ability and willingness to pass on price increases and so protect their margins. Now, the textbook answer of how to protect a fixed income portfolio from inflation would be to buy inflation-linked instruments, right? Gilts, okay. But let me just remind you, in 2022, there is a 2073 maturity index-linked sterling bond. Its total return in 2022 was -68%.
Ooh,
so,
whoa.
Yes, yeah. You had inflation protection in that the coupons and ultimate principal are adjusted by RPI, but when yields did what they did, it is washed away in an instant. And that bond is down 9% this year to date. So, you know, I've been asked by a lot of people, you know, outside the industry, you know, well, you've got these index-linked bonds, haven't you? Well, surely they would have protected you. No, the duration impact absolutely outweighs it.
Sonia, back to you. Does this environment of higher for longer interest rates that Mark's just alluded to mean that corporate distress will be hard to avoid? Will there be casualties?
Before I talk about the casualties, I would like to pick up parts of what Mark and Stu have said, because it's worth taking a step back to understand the implications of the adjustment process to a higher interest rate environment. We have tried to digest the shock. We had fallouts. We are still looking to understand the implications on the economic cycle. But in both their answers, you can see the importance of the base rate in valuation, liquidity premium, relative valuation attractiveness. That adjustment process is not over. And that is incredibly important, that to distinguish the impact that it will have on the economic cycle, and clearly then weaker risk assets and, you know, the adjustment. And yes, there will be casualties, but that is not unusual from any other cycle we've been through. What is unusual is that this is coming on the back of an inflation shock, one of the fastest hiking cycles in history, and an adjustment process that is by no means over. And hence, trying to understand the opportunity set is understanding that this adjustment process will go on for a lot longer, and that in future, what we have thought about as an attractive, you know, valuation level, even liquidity premium, is probably no longer relevant, because everything has been set up and has been judged against a period where central banks globally were at its most supportive. Capital was available for zero cost to everyone who'd asked for it, and this is going to change. Every company now will have to judge an investment project against an internal rate of return that is more expensive. Every private equity company, everything yep. in our financial world is priced off the risk-free rate. And if the one-year yield is at 5.25%, trust me, you know, all these projects now look a lot less attractive than they looked just 1 year ago. And I think we have to make sure that we capture this in our thinking, because that inevitably means that overall return assumptions will be a lot lower going forward. But coming back to your questions, yes, there will be casualties, but I wouldn't read too much into it, because there's sufficient evidence in terms of the expectation for distress defaults, which are normal in an economic downturn. So if you go along with our assumption that, yes, the interest rate cycle will have an impact, we do expect the economy to slow down, you will see companies that will be in trouble. I think that's a normal part of the cycle. But to me, it's important that investors, you know, do understand, given that the inflationary backdrop is far stickier, and we are now assuming that interest rates will remain a lot higher, everything I just said obviously will weigh far higher in our consideration than the potential distress that we're going to see.
All right, so that brings me very nicely on to my next point, because you've outlined, Sonia, attitudes to risk. Stu, let me bring you in here. What is your attitude to risk more generally?
Okay, so if it's okay, because this does flow into risk, it would be remiss of me not to at least respond to the liquidity questions. I think Mark brings up a really, really important point here. So the LDI crisis shone a significant light on the concept of liquidity, the importance of it, particularly in the UK with regards to pension schemes. But it also comes back to the original point that I was making around how we define the private credit world that we're invested in. And then, if you like, the nature of the private credit world. And obviously, I'm focused very much on that investment grade space. So to Mark's point around, you know, the liquidity being, you know, extraordinarily important. Absolutely. Completely concur. But I think one of the important things is the type of credit that investors are trying to sell out of. And I think in the recent LDI crisis, we weren't looking at huge portfolios of investment grade private credit. I think actually we were looking at more leveraged funds and, you know, credit funds like that. And the investment grade private credits that we invest in, they're the kinds of investments which, if investors are holding them, they're very easily in specie as part of buyouts.
Well, what does that mean exactly?
Effectively, investors, you know, such as ourselves, are willing to take those on. The assets are MA eligible and the quality is in line with insurance demands. So actually, they're the kind of investments where they serve a real, if you like, liquid and buyout purpose. And because of some of those reasons, and also conscious of the economic cycle, my personal feeling is the inflow effect, which I totally agree with Mark on, I think, you know, is going to be more pronounced outside of the investment grade space. And I think we are potentially about to see that. So, Francis, back to the original question around our risk preference at this point. As you know, we're typically lending longer term on a buy and hold basis for pension schemes. So we're naturally focused on those stable investment grade private credit investments that create resilient portfolios. And there's always good opportunities up and down the credit curve, but we're generally focused on the sectors and borrowers that are less cyclical. So that means, you know, high quality corporate non-cyclicals, utilities, infrastructure and prime real estate. The preference right now at this point, I'm actually slightly preferring the A rating category to BBB, because I think the relative value there has been a tad better. and you get the, you know, the additional rating downside protections that can be very valuable. And some of the opportunities in this area are exactly what we like. I do expect some credit spread increases over the next 12 months as borrowing defaults increase across the general markets. But as I think as history has demonstrated, these types of less cyclical sectors tend to more quickly revert to the longer run pricing levels, particularly as investors have a flight to quality. And we also have to bear in mind, I think, the very sizable pension activity that's occurring in the UK as schemes move to buyout. And that naturally supports demand for those high quality, longer assets. From a risk perspective, we're very, very sensitive to issuers that are sensitive to inflationary pressures and the ability to manage both cost inflation. And also we're very focused on issuers with good liquidity.
Should we just take a step back, all related, but obviously just to comment at the last FOMC meeting for the US Federal Reserve. And we've come up with the lingo, what is it, hawkish pause. I've never heard of that before, but anyway, we'll go
we
with
have.
It.
We have, don't worry, Francis.
Okay, all right, good. I'm glad someone on this call knows what they're talking about. So, Mark, with that in mind, and how's this affected sovereign bonds in particular, and what do you think of the likely implications for you?
The hawkish pause wasn't a huge surprise, right? Okay. The last FOMC was June the 14th, 15th, I think. The next one is July the 25th. What we've seen happen, so 2-year yields are up around about 30 basis points since then. 10-year yields are probably up about 15. So we've seen a further inversion of the curve, which, you know, everybody can read about and talk about. So that's the difference in yields between 2 years in the States and 10 years. Yeah. That's currently at a 40-year high, or low, whichever way you want to look at it, at minus 108 basis points. Ironically, NASDAQ is at its best start. But, you know, best start to the first half of the year for 40 years as well. And the curve is most inverted. And that curve inversion is amongst the most reliable predictors of recession. So kind of back to Sonia's opening comments. And what the Fed have said is that, you know, they will remain resolute in getting inflation back to target, but very data dependent. So all eyes, we've got payrolls this Friday. We've got US inflation next week. And those will be the numbers that the market is looking at. I'm not brave enough or clever enough or stupid enough to tell you what those numbers are likely to be, or even what the market reaction would be. I mean, if somebody told you what some of the numbers would have been last year before the event, you would definitely have got your positioning wrong based on, you know, historical evidence. So clearly there is a desire to get to 2% from Powell. And I think the Bank of England as well, right? And you can't. You know, if you've got 7.6% wage growth in the UK, then 2% inflation looks quite a long way off to me. Those two are not compatible. So those, whether it's wage numbers, whether it's vacancies, whether it's job openings, those are the key numbers that we're looking for, and but particularly inflation and core inflation. And see where that goes.
Yeah, central bankers have certainly got their work cut out for them, haven't they, still? Sonia, look, we've covered a lot of ground today. I'm pleased to say that it hasn't ended in a sparring match totally between Stu and Mark. I'm gonna give the final word to you, Sonia. Sum up your thoughts for us today.
Very happy to. And it's probably worth, given that we've had such an extraordinary first half, given that we are still in this balancing act, as Mark has just summarized on central bank, it is very clear that we are not yet in a position to really understand. We might see where interest rates will peak, but how quickly they can normalize, or when we will actually see the first an interest rate cut, I don't think we have a good understanding, because the underlying economic data is not supportive of that. That brings me to another key aspect of what investors have to grapple with, is the removal of the central bank put, which has been instrumental. We talked about liquidity, we talked about the risk attitude from investors. Clearly, with always the understanding, if things go wrong, central banks would step in. So there's another one we have to understand that they can't, because they have been all very, very clear that in this instance, inflation is the target for them to achieve. So that brings me just to a point in the context of markets trading at major inflection points, one that we have witnessed last year with the onset of the hiking cycle, and obviously all the factors that we've highlighted, and what this means for investors, because we had to learn that obviously equity and bonds very happily can trade in the same direction, and the impact this has on asset allocation. We have to understand that overall, we need to reconsider valuation level. We need to reconsider what the relative context is between asset classes. We need to understand how asset classes correlate with each other. And this is why it's been so interesting to understand the dynamics between private and public, because clearly there is a diversification benefit in combining the two, and where we are seeing investors really coming towards us to say, how are we taking this going forward? The opportunity set will be different, clearly, with the expectation of lower overall returns, simply because if interest rates remain higher, we cannot expect double-digit returns year in, year out. And that requires an understanding of opportunity sets. We haven't even touched on, you know, the longer-term structural drivers around geopolitics, decarbonizing the economy, and things like that. But it is important to understand that your framework of assessment and analysis has changed because of the interest rates being a lot higher than they have been over the past 10, 15 years. And hence, assessing opportunity sets will have to be done against this different context. There will be opportunities, lots of them, but there will be a lot of volatility as well. Because, as I think, Mark, you just said, you know, the wage inflation currently clearly is not compatible with a 2% inflation target. I'm wondering when central banks will pick up whether 2% actually is the right inflation target. They will definitely not do that now. That would confuse everyone. But, you know, this is really an inflection point, a point for markets that will be with us for quite some time and will lead to very many interesting debates.
All right. Well, we will look forward to a lot of interesting debates on markets going forward. But in the meantime, I have to end with the final question, which is tradition on the CIO call, which I have to ask you what you've been watching, reading or listening to recently. I'll kick off. I have been watching. I was lucky enough to go to Eastbourne last week to watch some tennis. And I am going home tonight to watch the Wimbledon highlights. So that's me done. Sonia, what about you?
Given that I'm married to an Indian and my son being a cricket fanatic, I've been I've been living through the pains of the Ashes over the weekend. I'm still asking, you know, what the various kind of scoring methodologies mean, but not quite sure I understood. But it's been a very interesting exercise.
You play for 5 days and it's still a draw.
I know. Don't get me started on that one.
Yes. Okay, Stu, what about you?
Won't keep this particularly highbrow, but I know you know that I love movies. At the weekend, I watched John Wick Chapter 4, which I have to say is one of the most fun films I've seen in years, and also has one of the most hilarious scenes on a set of stairs. So I will be going back and watching the whole series again this coming weekend.
We're all watchers. What about you, Mark?
So watching, I'm feeling a bit bereft after binging my way through Colin from Accounts and Ted Lasso. And actually, I've flipped it. Honestly, you've got to watch them both, right? I have flipped. So I'm actually watching it on to completely other end of the spectrum. Somebody said I should watch Once Upon a Time in Northern Ireland, which I'm watching on iPlayer, which is properly graphic and personal and reminds me of all the news headlines when I was kind of growing up listening. Okay, so listen, I'm a huge fan of Desert Island Discs, right? So if you listen to only one Desert Island Discs episode ever, go back onto the website, and because it's Wimbledon week, listen to the John McEnroe on Desert Island Discs. It is fantastic.
Oh, really? Is that a good one?
Yeah.
I might do that. All right. Well, talking of listening, thank you all so much for your time today. And thank you to our listeners for listening to this podcast. Thanks a lot. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, These do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2023. Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.